Dr. Sidley, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you loud and clear, thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. I apologize. I'm sorry, but since most of this was in English, I think you were able to listen and understand what Dr. Malone told us, right?
I understood. I can't claim to understand the nuances of the science. Yes, it was interesting, so there's no problem with me waiting.
Okay. Now, Dr. Malone was trying to keep as calm as possible, and I think he did because he says he tries to focus on evidence. His take on this is evidence-based. However, in the end, he was quite outspoken when he said that this experimental gene therapy is a violation of basic medical ethics, and in particular of the Nuremberg Code. Now, you are a clinical psychologist, and I'm pretty sure that you have a different take on this. I think it's your take on this is probably not as benign as that of Dr. Malone's, who's trying to stay out of the away from this, from these conspiracy theories.
I certainly don't self-identify as a conspiracy theorist. I think there is enough evidence now around suggests that a lot of what's going on is of questionable ethics, let's say, and that would include the issue of consent. I don't know where you want me to start with this, but kind of my main interest was around the psychological strategies.
That's probably the most important aspect of this, because right before we interviewed Dr. Malone, we were speaking with a German book author who also focused on the psychological aspects of what is going on here.
Right, okay. I missed that, so I hope I don't duplicate.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah. Just to say, I'm a retired clinical psychologist. Mm-hmm. I worked in the mental health services of our NHS for 33 years, initially as a psychiatric nurse, but for the most part, the clinical psychologist. Then I opted for early retirement in 2013. And since then, I've spent my time teaching, doing presentations and campaigning for a better response to human suffering. My interest in the coronavirus obviously started last year, and as I got more and more interested into that, I eventually joined up with HART, the Health Advisory Recovery Team, which you may have heard of. Mm-hmm. Do you need me to outline HART? It's a group of experts from medicine, science, the legal profession, and psychologists, whose primary aim is to try and open up the debate around COVID-19 and have a more balanced approach and look for the way forward that would minimize total harms. So that's what we're kind of striving for. As far as psychological strategies are concerned, my interest was kind of pricked at the early part of 2020 when we were struck by the relentless messaging, the fear messaging that was coming through our mainstream media, daily death counts, you know, continuously there on the screen without any context. For example, that over 1,600 people die each day in the UK under normal circumstances, but we just had this COVID-19 deaths meter that was ticking away, recurrent footage of inside hospitals, intensive care units with desperate patients gasping for breath, for example, in Lombardy in Italy. And of course, the mantras, the fear mantras, you know, you go out, you can spread it, people will die, coronavirus, anyone can get it, anyone can spread it. And those mantras typically accompanied by scary images of stressed out health professionals wearing visors and masks, all very powerful and very, very scary stuff. So that's what pricked my interest initially. And then I started to do a bit more research into who was responsible for this kind of communication strategy. And do stop me if you've already heard this morning.
No, we haven't heard this. But yeah. Let me translate before you go on with the next step. Dr. Gary Sidley ist ein pensionierter klinischer Psychologe. Seit 2013 ist er nicht mehr aktiv, aber seitdem arbeitet er weiter in der Lehre. Und er arbeitet für ein besseres menschliches Zusammenleben, unter anderem in einer Organisation, jetzt auch, die aufgrund von COVID gegründet worden ist, is HEART. Isn't it so that, isn't Dr. Mike Yeadon also a member of HEART?
He is.
Yeah. Okay. Er sagt, er hat angefangen, weil ihn diese ununterbrochene Beballerung in den Medien mit den täglichen Todeszahlen völlig außerhalb jeden Kontext aufmerksam gemacht hat. Also es sterben ohnehin in England, im UK 16.000 Menschen pro Tag.
Nee. 600, oder? Das bei uns sterben circa 200.
Nee, das habe ich wohl falsch. Oder ich habe jetzt die Zahl.
How many people die in the UK per day, usually?
Typically somewhere in the region of 1600 to 1700 people
also die. 1600, aber nicht 16.000.
Nein, ja genau, 1600, das ist richtig. Ach so, da war der Fehler, okay. Und die ständigen Bilder aus den Notaufnahmen in der Lombardei zum Beispiel und diese ständige Mantra, jeder kann Covid kriegen, jeder kann dran sterben, dann die Bilder der völlig abgestressten Mitarbeiter aus dem Gesundheitsbereich. Das hat ihn aufmerksam gemacht und dann hat er gesagt, jetzt gucke ich mir mal was anderes an. Okay, I'm sorry, go ahead.
It's fine, okay. Okay, so my interest pricked. I started to delve into who was behind some of these messaging campaigns. I learned more about the Behavioral Insights Team, which again I'm sure you've heard of a bit. Behavioral Insights Team, which was conceived of in the Prime Minister's office of David Cameron back in 2010. And I quote, it was supposed to be the world's first government institution dedicated to the application of behavioral science to policy. It was owned by the UK government and a charity called Nesta, as well as the Behavioral Insight Team employees. It had a very ambitious aim of improving people's lives and communities by applying these behavioral techniques. Rapidly expanded from 7 people back in 2010, based in the government office, right through to a social purpose company now operating in many countries across the world. So he has grown and expanded the Behavioral Insights Team. And I should say, in a nutshell, what they do is they use strategies, which are to various degrees covert, to shape people's behavior. To put it very simply, our mind, we can divide it into slow brain and fast brain. No, and fast brain dominates usually. We're on automatic pilot most of the time. And that's useful for the most part because we don't have the time to stop and think rationally and carefully about every decision that we have to make in life. We won't be able to function. So what happens? We have these rules of thumb, heuristic shortcuts, a bit like normative pressure, whereby if a lot of other people are doing something, we perhaps should do it as well, you know, without thinking. You know, it's that kind of automatic way of making decisions. And usually it's quite helpful, but in a way what behavioral science does, it exploits the automatic nature of that to actually get people to behave in the way that governments want them to behave. I hope that made sense. That's a quick outline of what they do. So I dug and started to learn more and more about these approaches. I'd heard about them in my career in the NHS, but I started to read a document called Mind Space, Influencing Behaviour Through Public Policy by Dolan et al, 2010. I can send you links to these if they are of any interest.
Yes, please.
Yeah. It was it's a document that's produced by the Institute of Government, and basically it talks about these behavioural strategies being, and I quote, low-cost, low-pain ways of nudging citizens into new ways of acting by going with the grain of how we think and act. So sometimes called the nudge unit, hence the word in there, nudging citizens. And it resorts to tools that do, for the most part, or for a, in a significant proportion of cases, act below people's level of consciousness and awareness. So people don't know they are being nudged, but they are, and it's strategic. I won't go into every kind of behavioral strategy, but MindSpace is an acronym for what's it, 9 different types of behavioral intervention. I also started to look more closely at what's going on with the coronavirus messaging and read a little bit more about the what we call the SPIB, which is the Scientific Pandemic Insights Group, which is a subgroup of SAGE. SAGE is our group of top advisors, scientists that advise the government on the coronavirus strategy. The SPIB is a subgroup of behavioral scientists and psychologists whose main role is to advise on the communication strategy.
What does that stand for again, SPIV?
Scientific Pandemic Insights Group for Behavior.
Okay.
SPIB, yes. The membership of the SPIB includes members of the Behavioral Insights team, and it also includes high-profile members of the British Psychological Society, which is, as the name suggests, is the professional body that oversees the practice of psychological techniques in the United Kingdom. The British Psychological Society's primary aim is, and I quote, to promote excellence and ethical practice in the science, education and application of the discipline. So that's their primary aim, which I think is relevant to what I come to in a moment, yeah, particularly the ethical bit.
Sounds very convincing.
It does, yes. So I then started to look more deeply at what specific kinds of nudge or behavioural strategy were being used in the COVID-19 messaging. And for me, there were 3 that stand out. The technical, rather euphemistical names are things like affect, ego, and norms, which I translate into fear, shaming, and peer pressure. The peer pressure, once it passes a certain threshold, becomes scapegoating, of course. With fear, you know, we know that a frightened population is a compliant one, and I think very, very tellingly, the SPIB minutes of the 22nd of March, 2020, mm-hmm. You may have heard this before, but it's crucial. In those minutes, and I quote, this is the advice that they're giving, I quote, the perceived level of personal threat needs to be increased among those who are complacent by using hard-hitting emotional messaging. And it also went on to say, we must use media to increase the sense of personal threat, unquote. And I think that's quite sinister, in my opinion. I mean, that is very explicitly stating that they're going to use inflating fear as a means of influencing behavior. And the problem with it, amongst other things, is that it's generalized. It's not differentiating between different sections of the population. You know, we know some parts of our society, particularly older people with, you know, vulnerabilities, existing vulnerabilities, they are, you know, at significant risk. But the majority, the risk is much smaller, and it doesn't fail. And a lot of the stuff that they do doesn't seem to recognise that there is that differentiation of risk between different parts of the population. The second major nudge they've used is the one they call ego, which I call shame. This is based on the fact that we all strive to maintain a positive self-image. We all like to believe that we're a good person and preserve that virtuous kind of self-view. And what the behavioral scientists have done, I believe, is very skillfully promoted the idea that compliance with the restrictions is akin to being a virtuous person, you know, quite black and white. So we've had all these mantras, things like, and I'll give you a few to give you a flavour of it, stay home, protect the NHS, save lives. So kind of suggesting that, you know, a good thing to save our National Health Service, almost like a religious status in this country. So that's an altruistic thing to do. Protect yourselves, protect your loved ones. And one that the former health secretary, Matt Hancock, used to say quite regularly, don't kill your gran. Yeah. Absolutely, said this several times in TV interviews, don't kill your gran. And then later we had these other adverts on TV saying things like, I wear a face covering to protect my mates. I make space to protect you. And then the awful one where they had this image of some poor person in hospital struggling to breathe. And the caption was, look them in the eyes and tell them you're doing all you can, which is for me both fear and shaming, really, as a double nudge, not one. And then, of course, we have the norms, normative pressure, the idea that we tend to be influenced by what we believe other people are doing. So we follow the crowd, by and large. If other people are doing it, probably it's okay to do it, so we tend to follow. And being in a deviant minority is a very uncomfortable place to be. And at its simplest, an example of this would be just simply politicians saying repeatedly, you know, the vast majority of people are following the rules. You know, that's a kind of a normative pressure. But much more importantly, I think, and this is a difficult one to prove, but I'm happy to share my views on it and some of the evidence I have for it, and that is that the mask mandates, they were brought in primarily as a means of getting people to comply by actually bringing normative pressure to bear on people rather than for any benefits in viral transmission. Because it's a mask is a visible indicator of pro-social compliance. Rule breakers can now be really easily distinguished. And that, I can say personally that being without a mask in a group of people who are masked is an uncomfortable place to be. Mm. Yeah, the pressure is palpable. Okay, and so then I went on to look at some ethical questions that were popping up in my head about this. And I think there are three areas where the ethical questions can be grouped. The first is with the problems with the methods per se. You know, is it right for a government to strategically and deliberately use fear inflation, shaming and peer pressure, maybe scapegoating, to influence the behaviour of its citizens? I think that's a really important question that at least is worthy of debate. I think that is an important question. And it's particularly so when you look at some of the collateral damage that has been inflicted by the inflation of fear in particular. You know, we've got evidence, I can send you it if you're interested, but evidence of things like parents too scared to take the children to A&E, even when they were acutely unwell. People too scared to attend hospitals with non-COVID illnesses. Old people isolated, dying of loneliness. You know, and there is some scientific evidence that loneliness can accelerate death in the elderly. So I think the problems with the methods per se. The second area, I would say, is problems with a lack of consent, which is something that you've touched on at the beginning. You know, informed consent is a cornerstone of medical and psychological practice, fundamental requirement. And even one of the leading lights in the behavioral science movement, Professor David Halpin, who sits on the SPIB and sits on SAGE, and he is a leading light in behavioral science. In his document, he co-wrote the Mindspace document, he was one of the authors of that. In there, and I quote, he says, policymakers wishing to use these tools need the approval of the public to do so. That's in the Mind document, page 74. And in David Alpern's book, very interesting book, Inside the Nudge Unit, it's called, written in 2019, again, I'll quote from him, he says, if governments wish to use behavioural insights, they must seek and maintain the permission of the public. Ultimately, you, the public, the citizen, need to decide what the objectives and limits of nudging and empirical testing should be. So that's in David Halpern's book, The Nudge Unit. So there's an acknowledgement of the importance of getting the people's consent before you use these things. And knowing any psychology students who propose research that intended to inflict emotional discomfort on citizens without the consent, I don't think they'd get that through an ethics committee in a university. So you know, you might ask, why is the public health behavioural psychologist, why are the rules for those different? And then thirdly, I think there's problems with the goals themselves, which might be the less important of the three queries around ethics. But it's, you know, I think it's fair to say that the way that pretty much most countries have approached the SARS-CoV-2 virus is using interventions that are unprecedented, non-evidence for the most part, and actually infringe basic human rights. So I had ethical questions. I don't know whether you want me to pause there for a translation or...
Im zweiten Schritt, nachdem Dr. Sidley festgestellt hat, dass hier eine merkwürdige, noch nie dagewesene tägliche, stündliche, minütliche Beballerung mit aus jedem Kontext gerissenen Angstbildern gemacht wurde, hat er gefragt, wer steckt denn wohl dahinter? Und da kam er auf das, what's the name of that insights team again?
Behavioral
Insights Team, genau. Da gibt es also ein Team, das sich mit Verhaltenseinsichten beschäftigt. Da sind Verhaltenswissenschaften dahinter. Und die benutzen diese Strategien, die man erst nur so erkennen konnte, wie er es auch eben gesehen hat, also dieses ständige Beballern, um das Verhalten der Menschen zu ändern. Dabei gehen sie insbesondere auf die, er hat den Unterschied gemacht zwischen dem langsamen Gehirn und dem schnellen Gehirn. Die gehen insbesondere auf den Bereich des Verhaltens ein, der reflexartig, der automatisch erfolgt. Das hat in der Regel ja auch seinen Sinn und das funktioniert auch ganz gut. Nur hier wird man eben unterschwellig über genau diese ansonsten gut funktionierenden Reaktionen manipuliert. Normalerweise, sagt er, sind diese schnellen automatischen Reaktionen hilfreich. Hier aber werden sie ausgenutzt für die Manipulation durch Mindspace zum Beispiel. Das haben wir auch von Brian Garish, UK Column. He told us a few of these things, not as detailed as you did. Diese Organisation, Regierungsorganisation Mindspace, hat versucht mit geringem Aufwand, oder das ist deren Ziel, mit geringem Kostenaufwand die Bevölkerung zu nudgen, zu schieben in eine Richtung, und zwar so, dass sie es nicht merken, auf 9 unterschiedlichen Ebenen. Im dritten Schritt hat Dr. Sidley sich dann mit den spezifischen Corona-Eingriffen näher beschäftigt. Da gibt es eine Untergruppe von SAGE. SAGE ist die wichtige für die Corona-Bekämpfung zusätzliche zuständige Regierungsorganisation mit ein paar Wissenschaftlern da drin. Da gibt es eine Untergruppe, SPIV, die sich mit genau diesen psychologischen Eingriffen, diesen Manipulationstechniken beschäftigt. Die gehört zur britischen Psychologengesellschaft, oder da sind viele, viele Mitglieder der British Psychological Society drin. Wie arbeiten die? Ja, er hat seine Übersetzung gefunden mit im Wesentlichen drei Elementen, nämlich einmal mit Angst, Panik, haben wir ja auch schon öfter gehört. Das führt zu Compliance, also dazu, dass die Menschen aus lauter Angst erstmal mitmachen. Das zweite ist Shaming. Wer nicht mitmacht, ist sozusagen ein Ausgestoßener. Und das dritte ist Peer Pressure. Wer abweicht von, wer in einer Minderheitengruppe ist, der wird sich sehr schnell unbequem fühlen. Das beste Beispiel dafür sind diese Maskenzwänge, die aus Sicht von Dr. Sidley nur einem einzigen Zweck dienen, nämlich sichtbar zu machen, wer sich an die Regeln hält und die nicht angepassten sich möglichst schlecht fühlen zu lassen. Diese SPIV hat Dr. Sidley eben erklärt, da gibt es ein Protokoll aus dem März 2020 und das entspricht unserem Panikpapier. Man muss mit harten emotionalen Angriffen zuschlagen, um die Menschen zu manipulieren. Der frühere Gesundheitsminister, skandalumwitterte Gesundheitsminister Matt Hancock, ein wirklich unangenehmer Mensch, der ausschließlich fake zu sein scheint, das ist mein Kommentar, nicht seiner, hat mit diesen Maßnahmen auch gearbeitet und zum Beispiel auch im Fernsehen öfter gesagt, bring deine Oma nicht um, don't kill your granny. Oder es wurde das Bild von um Luft ringenden Menschen gezeigt und darunter stand dann, guck denen in die Augen und sag denen, dass du alles, was du tun kannst, auch tust. Im nächsten Schritt hat er sich dann um die ethischen Fragen, die sich aus diesem Zusammenhang ergeben, gekümmert. Ist das eigentlich in Ordnung, war die erste Frage, wenn die Regierung sowas macht? Und zwar deshalb, weil er sagt, das ist deshalb wichtig, weil wir ja schon sehen können, dass hier massive Kollateralschäden, da haben wir Evidence für, massive Kollateralschäden beim Menschen daraus folgen. Zum Beispiel sind viele Menschen so ängstlich gewesen, dass sie nicht sich in dringend benötigte medizinische Behandlung begeben haben oder ihre Kinder da nicht hingeschickt haben. Das werden wir alles noch sehen, was das für weitergehende Folgen hat. Alte Menschen sind in der Isolation gestorben. Und da sagt er, dann braucht man da, das allein ist auf jeden Fall Grund genug, sich die ethische Frage zu stellen, darf so eine Regierung sowas überhaupt? Inzwischen haben wir ja von Ulrich Mies gehört, das ist ja gar nicht mehr die Regierung. Und dann auch die Frage des Informed Consent, um die hat er sich auch gekümmert. Und eines der Mitglieder dieser SPIV-Gruppe, also dieser Psychomanipulationsgruppe, der heißt David Halpin und hat sogar ein Buch geschrieben in 2019, wo er darauf hinweist, dass man solche Experimente mit Menschen nicht machen darf, es sei denn, die stimmen zu. Und die letzte Frage, die vorletzte Frage, die er sich gestellt hat, die wir hier gerade besprechen, ist, was ist eigentlich mit den Zielen? Sind die nicht vielleicht schon selber höchst problematisch? Es hat es noch nie diese Maßnahmen sind noch nie da gewesen. Die hat es nicht gegeben, unprecedented. Und sie sind vor allem nicht evidence-based. Bringen die überhaupt was? Offenbar nicht. Okay.
Okay, can I ask a question? You know, I think that the masks not only serve the purpose that to make it visible who's complying and who's not, but they also are needed, I guess, for some sort of manifestation that the virus exists, you know, or that the danger exists, because otherwise you just wouldn't see it. Even if it's dangerous, you would see everyone just walking around. But now if you see the buses go by and everyone is with a mask, this looks so dangerous, there must be something to it. You know, that's maybe another purpose. But I was also wondering, just a remark, but why do you think other people or us, we can see it? I mean, what's different, you know, between the ones who get really scared and intimidated or feel like scapegoats or whatever when they don't comply, and us or other people who are maybe 20% who are critical or whatever? What's different in their psychological structure or whatever that they don't fall to these nudging efforts?
That is an excellent question and one I've been asked many times. I'm not sure I've actually come up with a definitive answer as yet, but I think partly it's probably to do with having an alternative narrative, being able to quite quickly form at least a tentative alternative explanation for what's going on. And at the moment, I'm trying to put together, and I've put together a sort of propaganda detox pack, a three-step, which involves developing an alternative narrative, unplugging from mainstream media. So I don't know what it's like in other countries, but the media in the UK I think it's been horrendous. It's been, you know, all the mainstream channels have just continually bombarded us with fear messaging throughout this, with visuals, you know, everybody masked up. Thankfully, there's one or two channels breaking through, like GB News now, are a bit more, a lot more broad-based and allow opposing views. But for the most part, our media has been awful. So step two of the detox would be, you know, turn off the turn off the mainstream media and go for a walk in nature and become mindful and concentrate on the here and now kind of thing. The third point, which kind of relates to your really important issue, point you made about fear, you know, mass is another one of my pet subjects, and I agree entirely. Mass propagate fear in two ways, I think. One is the obvious one, is that they're a blatant symbol that danger is nearby. You know, one or both of us is a biohazard, and that keeps the fear going. More subtly and a bit more psychologically embedded is the idea that the masks are a very potent safety behavior. Mm-hmm. You know, any psychologist who's worked with people with fears know that the main way of overcoming fears is to not avoid things, but also while you're not avoiding, to make sure you're not carrying out any little precaution that's kind of neutralizing the awareness that it's now safe enough. So in other words, somebody going into, if somebody this week, when hopefully some of the mandates are lifted and we all pile back into normal life there or thereabouts, if somebody continues to wear a mask, you know, they can mix with people for a week or 2 weeks, 3 weeks and survive without any problem. But the chances are that they'll attribute their survival to having worn the mask rather than concluding that it's safe enough to go out there now.
Yeah.
I think that's a really important point, because I think masks will perpetuate fear, and it's nonsense when people say, oh, it's reassuring others, it'll help people get back to normal. No, on the contrary, it will not help people get back to normal. It will perpetuate these inflated fear levels that we've got. But if I could, shall I come, just quickly come back and finish off with the BPS thing, because I'll be as quick as I can, but armed with my knowledge of what the British Psychological Society Code of Ethics says, I won't bore you with the detail, but I've mentioned little bits already about them being the overseers of ethical practice of psychology. What happened was that I wrote a letter along with 46 other psychologists and therapists as co-signatories on the 6th of January 2021. To the British Psychological Society, raising my concerns. So I highlighted the previously mentioned ethical issues that I've shared with you today. I mentioned parts of their own code of ethics, which these approaches seem to infringe. And then I concluded with five questions to them. One was, is it ethical to use covert psychological strategies on British citizens without their consent? Number two was, is it ethical to use covert psychological strategies to increase compliance with a contentious public health policy? Three, I asked, does the BPS agree that psychologists recommending the use of fear, shame and scapegoating to promote compliance or practice in a way that infringes their code of ethics? Four, in light of these concerns, what actions do they intend to take? And five, to minimise the chances of recurrence, will the BPS publicly condemn the use of psychological skills knowledge for this purpose? So that was sent on the 6th of January. I got a reply a month later, 5th of February, from a person called Dr. Deborah Malpass, who's the Director of Knowledge and Insight at the British Psychological Society. My sense was that it failed to directly address any of my ethical concerns and was quite evasive and disingenuous. You know, she argued, for instance, it's not possible to conclude that covert rather than overt behaviour strategies have been used. She argued that the specific role of psychologists is not always evidenced. She talked about their own guidance, i.e. the BPS, British Psychological Society's guidance, is based on established evidence-based frameworks. and then cited material written by a core written by Professor Susan Michie, who is a senior figure on the British Psychological Society and on the SBIB group. And there are a number of high profile people who sit on both the British Psychological Society and the SBIB. Anyway, I won't go through it all, but and she finished off, we are incredibly proud of the fantastic work done by psychologists throughout the pandemic. So clearly didn't seem to think there was any issue that was worth a broader debate about as far as the ethics were concerned. So I wasn't particularly satisfied with that. So on the 9th of February, I messaged the chair of the British Psychological Society Ethics Committee and asked, did they actually discuss the letter at their ethics committee, their monthly ethics committee? Did my letter actually get there? Or was it kind of intercepted before that and just got that response I've just mentioned? And could they clarify that for me? 7 days later, I got another message from Dr. Malpass, Deborah Malpass, basically saying, your letter will be considered at the next meeting of the BPS Ethics Committee on the 1st of March. So clearly, the letter hadn't got to the Ethics Committee with the prompt. It was now going on the 1st of March. It got to the 12th of March, and I hadn't heard anything further at all from them, so I prompted them again. And then I got a response from a Dr. Roger Paxton, who's the chair of the BPS Ethics Committee, and I'll read you his response. He said, dear Dr. Sidley, my intention was that the Ethics Committee on the 1st of March would consider the wider ethical issues raised in your letter. I'm sorry that owing to a very full agenda and an oversight on my part, this discussion did not take place. I apologise for this. I plan now to take your letter to the next meeting, which apparently was in June. So I got to the 30th of June and still had no further contact. I think you're probably noticing a pattern here. Then on the 1st of July, after I prompted them again, I got another response from Dr. Paxton, the chair of the Ethics Committee. He confirmed that the Ethics Committee had now considered our letter and the previous response from Dr. Malpass, and that the Ethics Committee had endorsed that previous response. And he went on to say that the methods you refer to as covert are in fact indirect, but not concealed or secret. The committee rejected your characterization of decisions about social contacts as in the sphere of individual health decisions. So my reading of that, and it's not entirely clear, I think, is that they're arguing that individual kind of consent and individual rights is sort of not really important in this kind of situation. It's trumped by the broader societal needs. I think the collective is more than the individuals, I think. That was my interpretation of it. I don't know. That seemed to be what he was saying. They argue that the fear levels that we see in our society are consistent with the threat of the virus, which again I think is a rather dubious assertion. They went on to say that given the scale of the mortality and morbidity caused by the pandemic, it was thought unsurprising that awareness of these facts led to fear. And their overall conclusion, just to round off, was that, and I quote, overall, the Ethics Committee believed that the contributions of psychologists in responding to the pandemic were entirely consistent with the BPS Code of Ethics and Conduct, demonstrating social responsibility and the competent and responsible employment of psychological expertise. So a pretty robust refutation, really, of my questions about the ethical, the dubious ethical basis of a lot of these approaches. And at the moment, we're just deliberating on our next step.
I'll translate this. Yeah. Also, Viviane hat gefragt, warum nicht alle darauf hereinfallen, auf diese expliziten psychologischen Manipulationen. Ja, sagte, einige von uns schaffen sowas wie den Propaganda-Detox, die schalten dann einfach ab. Und er empfiehlt auch weiter, wenn man darauf nicht reinfallen will, dann sollte man vielleicht auch in der Natur sein. Und im Übrigen würde ja dieses massenhafte Maskentragen der Öffentlichkeit suggerieren, dass das erforderlich ist. Deswegen würden eben die meisten Menschen durch dieses Maskentragen einem dauerhaften Angstzustand ausgesetzt sein. Einige von uns machen da eben nicht mit. Der hat dann eben umfangreich geschildert, wie er und eine Gruppe von anderen Psychologen einen Brief an die britische Psychological Society geschickt hat, betreffend den Code of Ethics. 5 Fragen hat er gestellt, unter anderem diejenige, das war glaube ich im Januar 21, unter anderem diejenige, wie erklärt ihr, dass ihr eigentlich hier nicht ohne Zustimmung, ohne Einwilligung arbeiten dürft? Eine andere Frage war, kann man wirklich diese umstrittenen Maßnahmen, die ja nicht evidence-based sind, tatsächlich auf diese Weise erzwingen? Und die dritte oder vierte Frage war, was habt ihr jetzt zukünftig vor? Wollt ihr das nicht mal öffentlich dem Ganzen eine Absage geben und das Ganze beenden? Einen Monat später hat er eine Antwort gekriegt von einer Frau. Da sagt er, das war ausweichend und unehrlich, also offensichtlich sowas wie ein Formschreiben, wie wir es ja hier auch kennen von den Behörden, die fast nie auf den konkreten Fall eingehen. Dann hat er nachgelegt und hat gefragt, habt ihr den Brief überhaupt bekommen? 7 Tage danach, dieselbe Frau, die vorher geschrieben hat, sagt, oh, wir gucken uns das mal genauer an. Also hatte sie es offenbar nicht oder vielleicht bekommen, aber nicht gesehen oder nicht sich angesehen. Dann hat er am 1. Juli von dem Vorstand des Essex Committee, Dr. Paxton, einen Brief bekommen, der sich dann doch ein bisschen näher damit auseinandergesetzt hat, aber wieder nur mit fadenscheinigen oder ich übersetze das immer mit Drückerkolonnen Geschwätz geantwortet haben. Es seien ja gar keine heimlichen, also hinter dem Rücken der manipulierten Menschen stattfindenden Manipulationen, nicht covert, sondern die seien ja nur indirekt. Im Übrigen müsse man sich für das große Ganze einsetzen. Es geht hier um das kollektive Wohl der Menschen. Das ist viel wichtiger als die Personen, die von einzelnen Maßnahmen betroffen sind. Und das Ganze sei der Bedrohung durch das Virus angemessen. Kein Evidence, nix. Well, we know these kinds of form letters, which have really nothing to say. As you said, evasive or evasive and not very truthful, I guess. They're just doing it because they're going through the motions, more or less. That's the impression that I'm getting.
The thing is, these fear tactics, though, there's evidence that they've had such a huge impact on our society here in the UK, and I'm sure across various parts of the world. We're supposed to be opening up soon, but yet various opinion polls suggest that maybe 40-50% of people are still frightened about returning into some kind of normality. On a more scientific basis, a psychology colleague of mine at Hart is called Professor Mark Antonio Spada, S-P-A-D-A, who you may have heard of, I don't know. He's been done a lot of work in London looking at what he calls this COVID anxiety syndrome, which is a group of characteristics and unhelpful strategies that people are adopting, particularly around avoidance, worry, threat monitoring, checking. And he reckons that at least 1 in 5 people in the UK, and his quote is, markedly affected by this COVID anxiety syndrome. And the UK is one of the, I think, up there as the most scared country in the world. He's done some comparisons across countries in Europe, and the UK is you know, the levels are so high here. Compared to other countries. So the damage of that is potentially widespread in the collateral effects of that. The,
Yeah.
I don't know whether you want me to pause. I only have one thing. I know I have to finish shortly, won't I? But I just, there was just something on to say a little bit more about mass, but I'll be direct.
I have two small questions. Like, one is, we've been observing that people who are aware of what's going on, that they still at some point, and sometimes even out of the blue, decide to get vaccinated. You know, sometimes it's a doctor telling them, oh, I got just like one shot left here. And then even, you know, they've even been following our committee and like, you know, so they really know about the problems with the vaccinations, the health risks and other things. And, you know, and all of a sudden, boom, although they know what's going on, they decide to do this. So that's very strange. I was wondering if you'd have maybe an explanation for that.
Yes, I think I do. And I would say, again, the psychological nudges, the covert psychological strategies, have been applied relentlessly to the vaccination campaign. And just to give you one specific example of that, in a formal document produced by our National Health Service, co-written by the behavioural scientists, of course, in there, they were advising health workers to tell young people, and I quote what they were saying, they were advising health workers to tell young people, normality can only return for you and others with your vaccination. Now, that's a shaming thing to say, isn't it? You know, is it? In other words, if you're a good person and you want other people to get back to normal, you've got to go and get your vaccine. With the elderly, they were really laying it on, you know, with, you know, you're three times more likely to die. And just think how terrible you will feel if you don't get vaccinated and then you catch COVID-19. Yeah. You know, really emotional leverage. So that's at least a partial answer to your question. That's why people have flocked to get vaccinated. I think it's part of the consequences of the nudges that they're exposed to, again, relentlessly. You know, on TV, incentives, and now, of course, here we've just announced that you've got to be double jabbed to avoid quarantine if you go on holiday. You know, we have got a medical apartheid that's being imposed on us, I fear.
And another question I have, do you think, because we feel, I mean, this seems to be like a worldwide script that's going on. You know, we also had this, like, called here like the panic paper, where they also suggested this kind of thing with don't kill your granny by, you know, being too close to them, even for, like, for children or something like that. And so we think
it's almost verbatim the same.
It's really interesting. And we also have the same terms, you know, like this social distancing, which is not a German, it's never heard of, basically. And we even use the English term for that. So we think it might be something that's comes from the English-speaking realm, you know, where the script is produced. And I was wondering, do you think it might come, like, from this SAGE subsection and then it's kind of rolled out over the world? Or do you think there's more like a PR agency involved? Or how do you think that works?
I don't know. I'm sorry. It's a really good question again, isn't it? One that I've asked myself many times. I'd like to emphasize, I've never been one who's been prone to conspiracy theories. You know, I've tended to resist them. I've always been of the view that probably the simplest explanation is probably the right one. And I did cling to the idea that all this was primarily due to a combination of incompetence and panic by our government leaders at the beginning. But as it's gone on, it would appear that opportunistic agendas have jumped on it, and they're just, you know, pushing their own political and ideological agendas. There is clearly some organisation, because I agree with you, the same terms and same approaches seem to be cropping up. Although I then do remember that the Behavioural Insights team are embedded in a lot of different countries across the world now, so maybe that's not too surprising. I don't know. But as far as what the definitive answer is, I remain curious. And then, you know, I hope we find out.
Yeah, I hope so too.
Yeah.
We'll have to take many, many more closer looks. But in my view, from what we have learned in now 60 sessions of this Corona Committee, from talking to all these experts, the pieces of the puzzle do seem to make a very easily visible picture now, overall picture. And in my view, my personal view, this has nothing to do with health and everything to do with a small, super rich group of people trying to gain control over the rest of the world before they are found out, because I think they're in panic too.
Yes, you may well be right.
But that's a conspiracy theory, maybe. Okay. Well, okay.
Thanks so much. Fantastic.
Is there something that...
Just very quickly, if I may, just to finish off with the mass, as I said, it's very close to my heart. And in fact, I'm heavily involved in an anti-mass campaign here in the UK called Smile Free. smilefree.org, which is trying to get all the mass mandates lifted and for them never to return. But just in the thing about the mass being a compliance device, although that's quite difficult to prove, there are a number of bits of evidence that would be consistent with that. I think, you know, like the World Health Organization flip-flopping with their advice, you know, even as late as December 2020, we're saying, and again, I quote, there's only limited and inconsistent scientific evidence to support the effectiveness of masking healthy people in the community. All the public figures, or public health figures in the UK up until spring, early summer, were all against masking the healthy. You know, our chief medical officer, deputy medical officer, chief scientific officer, all saying it's a bad idea. And that flipped without any obvious evidence to suggest that masks were helpful. We had a respected Channel 4, one of our TV channel journalists, who actually asked the World Health Organization back in June whether they changed their advice because of political lobbying. And the World Health Organization didn't deny it. So again, circumstantial evidence, but all suggestive when taken together. And I don't know whether you're familiar with Laura Dodsworth and her book, State of Fear.
Nope.
Oh, excellent book. Well worth reading. It came out about a month or so ago. It's called The State of Fear by Laura Dodsworth. And amongst other good things, she's actually interviewed some members of the SPIB group, the subgroup. One of them, a couple of them actually being named as well. And one of the SPI members, an educational psychologist called Gavin Morgan, is quoted as saying around masks that he was dead against them. He thought they were dehumanizing. But he said some SAGE members believe that masks usefully give a sense of solidarity.
Oh, yeah, right. Well, there's a new study out. There's a very new study out, a brand new study that
JAMA Pediatrics, I think it's
it was published in the American Journal of Pediatrics, and it shows, among other things, that the CO2 concentration behind the mask is 7 times, and this concerns children in particular, 7 times over the limit that is considered dangerous. So this does not make any sense. Dr. Sidley, I don't want to cut you short, but Dr. Martin has been waiting for a bit. So I thank you very, very much for your time and the enlightening explanations that you're giving us about who and what is behind this mass psychological manipulation. That's what it boils down to.
No, thank you for inviting me, giving me the opportunity. And anything else that you want to know, if there are any links or any snippets of evidence you're interested in, just get in touch and I'll happily forward it to you.
Super.
We'll take you up on this. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.